When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to Money Talks, a special extra podcast from Slate Money where we have conversations with brilliant and interesting people. I'm Emily Peck, co-host of Slate Money, and I'm here today with Chloe DeMong. Chloe is the writer and director of the Netflix erotic thriller slash finance drama Fair Play, which came out last year. She was a director on Billions and the Rocks TV series Ballers, and has done so many more great things. Chloe, welcome to Money Talks.
Thank you for having me.
So on Slate Money, we usually cover business and finance news. We don't typically get into erotic thrillers or talk about any of the more dramatic personal stuff that happens behind the scenes at work, typically. But I wanted to talk to you because Fair Play gets into this dynamic that people don't talk about enough, this gender dynamic between men and women, where women are successful, sometimes more successful than their partners, but they feel kind of bad about it, ashamed. There's a whole dynamic where the man thinks he's supposed to be more successful, and when the woman outshines him, well, we'll get into it. I mean, I should say that the movie is about a young couple working at a hedge fund. Their relationship basically starts to fall apart after the woman, Emily, played by Phoebe Dynevor, gets a promotion, and the man, Luke, is played by Alden Ehrenreich. People may know him from Solo. He gets jealous and awful things happen. So yeah, I mean, we don't typically see this kind of interplay in a movie and we don't talk about it a lot. Why did you want to show it on screen?
For that exact reason. You know, I think that it's something that we deal with every day in different shades. I think it's something we deal with in the workplace. I think it's something we deal with behind bedroom, you know, doors. And I would say the reason why I wanted to make it was this is something that I had been experiencing for so many years in many different relationships. You know, I'm someone who has always been very ambitious. And I think even before I started to even get any little bit of success, my ambition just in and of itself felt like a threat very early on in certain relationships. And sometimes I felt like I would have to kind of undermine my excitement over certain, you know, ambitions, or, you know, when I started to get certain career opportunities, I would undermine my excitement for those things in front of my male partner who wasn't, you know, doing as well at the time or was struggling or just didn't feel good about himself in whatever that moment was. And it was something that I just normalized. And I think it's something that so many women normalize and just accept, and we don't talk about it and we don't acknowledge it, because I think it's a scary thing to acknowledge, especially in a progressive. I mean, I've lived in progressive cities, I've dated progressive men. The idea that, you know, kind of if I were to admit that this was something that was actually going on, then, you know, what would that say about me and my choice of partner, and what would that say about, you know, I mean, everything. It just feels like I personally just wasn't able to confront it. And it was something that after many years, as my career started to take off and I got more and more jobs. And I think as I was dealing with more and more passive aggressive comments, and it took me many years to realize that all the tension in my relationship was stemming from that. And once I did realize it, you know, and I was more aware of it, it became very painful. But it, you know, those tensions didn't go away, and I think they just got worse. You know, the more my career accelerated, and it just got to a point where it became intolerable for me, and I got pretty angry about it. I'm like, why is this something? Why do I have to live my life like this? You know, and why is this something that we both kind of have to suffer through? And why is this something that we're afraid to talk about? And so that's why I wrote the movie.
Wow. There's a scene in the movie, and you talked about this in a video I was watching online earlier, but there's a scene that I think really encapsulates what you're saying in the dynamic, because the dynamic isn't just that the guy feels uncomfortable because his partner's outshining him, you're saying like you also feel a discomfort. Like you know subconsciously that you're not supposed to be more successful than your partner. You don't really think that probably, but like you kind of like feel it in your gut. So you have that scene early on in the movie where the Emily character comes home. She's just gotten a promotion. It's like great news. But the scene is like, it's shot and it comes across like you're on the edge of your seat. Like you're so anxious. She has to tell her boyfriend she's gotten a promotion, which is like, again, good news. But the whole scene is like fraught with all this like anxiety. She can hardly look at him. Mm-hmm. He finally says to her, I'm so happy for you. But his eyes are like dead when he says it. I'm so happy for you. It's just so, it's so amazing.
Yeah. So it's not like she feels like she doesn't deserve it, right? It's not like she has been working, you know, her whole adult life, like towards this moment, towards getting this opportunity and this promotion. But it's more like this feeling that she feels like he can't handle it. There is just this unspoken, ingrained kind of foundation of stuff and feelings that I think is just ingrained in so many of us. And just this idea that, yeah, can a man handle a woman's success if he's not doing well himself, or if he's not maybe one step ahead? And it's just this fear that her accelerating past him will cost her relationship. And so her first reaction, I mean, she apologizes for her success. And it's because she is afraid that her relationship will suffer in some way because of her success. And I think that that's a fear that so many women have experienced, you know, on very different levels. And then I would say on the one hand, you know, Luke, I was really trying to show that in many ways he represents the modern man of a certain age, you know, a man who was super progressive, who adores Emily because she's intelligent, who adores her because she's a killer, like because she's good at her job. Like that's why he's attracted to her. At the same time, because of the way he was raised, right, under more traditional ideas of gender roles, you know, at a time where his parents, you know, his father was probably the breadwinner and his mother, you know, stayed at home. Just of what was ingrained in him, there's this feeling like he needed to get there first. And so it's like that struggle between those two things is what causes like his reaction to it, knowing that he is on one hand excited for her, but also shocked and almost paralyzed. Like he never really actually thought that she would pass him, that it was fine when they're on the same level and their relationship works either when they're on the same level or he's one step ahead. And obviously all the cracks start to show once the thing gets flipped.
Right. It makes me think about this thing people say, which is, you're going to let a girl beat you. I just was in a situation where a family member said that to a younger member of my family. And I was just, that's it. You know, you're going to let a girl beat you is like the whole mechanism behind the whole phenomenon in a way. Like Luke can't let Emily beat him, you know, like you're not supposed to. That's the rules of the playground. And I feel like we all know that deep down. But I wanted to talk more about Luke because later in the film, Luke kind of like goes a little incel-y. Like he starts reading these books. And what were you trying to show with that, do you think?
He cannot accept the idea that he didn't get the job because he's inferior. He cannot accept that. He cannot face that. So he's starting to look for answers in all the wrong places to give him this idea of like that he is of value, but there, you know, something outside of his control prevented him from having it. But the fact, you know, but this is a man who can't face his own failures and his own weakness. And so he starts kind of going down the rabbit hole, looking for reasons, other reasons of why he didn't get it. And other reasons that can help him kind of boost up his confidence again to get the thing that he wants. So I feel like it, you know, it's at this point in the film where he's so insecure, he's so rattled by this thing that happens. And I just think that there are these Jordan Peterson type figures out there who kind of prey on these men dealing with the crisis of masculinity. He feels like this is a path that can help him kind of reclaim his masculinity and his sense of purpose and get him back on the track towards something that he believes he deserves.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
So in the movie, I mean, neither Emily nor Luke, neither of them really come off that well. Like, there is a scenario where you could have really played it as like Emily is the good one. And I'm not just saying that because my name's Emily, but it does roll off my tongue that Emily's the good one and Luke is, you know, the villain. But like later on in the movie, there's this one thing that Emily does that really makes it clear, I think. Well, makes it clear. She does this thing, which is kind of like, it's like kind of a big lie. And it's the kind of thing that like men will accuse women of doing in the workplace, you know, making up facts sometimes. So I was sort of curious why like complexify Emily in that way. What does it say about the whole dynamic, do you think?
Well, I would say in general, I didn't set out to make a film where there's a stereotypical villain and a stereotypical victim because I don't think that's interesting.
Yeah.
And also, I don't think that that's real life. I think that we're all complex and we're all flawed. I mean, look, when I've been in toxic relationships, I have not been the best version of myself. You know, I think when you're in that kind of toxic environment, the ugliest version of yourself can come out too. That was one thing that I was going for there. But also, I mean, I would say in terms of the lie that she tells Campbell, I mean, to me, like I actually find that scene very tragic and quite devastating because the scene right before that is her covering up her bruises from the assault. And instead you would think that, okay, the step after that would be to go to the police, you know, report what happened and whatever. But instead it's like, if she were to report what happened, she would have to admit that they were together, that then, you know, they were breaking company policy because it's against, you know, company policy and this fear that she would lose her job. So the reason why, you know, it's like she has to hide her sexual assault to save face with her boss and to save her job. And then she has to make up this lie because in her mind, it's the only way to save her job. And the thing is, at that point, Luke has already, I mean, he's already outed her in the most obscene way in the office that he's not coming back to that place. So really for me, that moment is she has to go to this extreme place to protect her job. And I don't know, I personally find that scene quite devastating.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of like the most extreme version of something people do all the time, which is like cover up their real lives at work in various ways. Yeah. I was also going to ask you why, I mean, this dynamic happens in all kinds of workplaces. Why finance? Why'd you pick a hedge fund?
I think, you know, for a number of reasons. I would say, you know, my experience with these kinds of dynamics was, you know, my experience and kind of my rise in the world of television. And I was getting more and more kind of opportunities in the commercial space and in the television space and the relationships I had while those things were happening. I think that there are a lot of parallels to my experience in television to the finance world. And I have a lot of friends in the finance world, and it felt like, just for example, just the high stakes nature of that world, the amount of money that's on the table when you're shooting a scene. And if you don't make your day on a certain show, you cost the production hundreds of thousands of dollars and the pressure of that, you know, and the high stakes nature of that. And then it's also that on one day, you know, if I'm directing a show, let's say the show is a 7-day shoot. It's like on one day you make your day, you shoot the scenes, everyone's super happy, you're a hero. And then on the next day, it's like something happens and you don't finish a scene and suddenly you cost, you know, production hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's how it can fluctuate so quickly to you being like kind of, you know, on top of the world and then feeling so low and at the bottom, and how it can fluctuate so quickly in a matter of, you know, 24 hours or less. That to me is very similar to what it feels like to work in finance. You know, on one day you can make the firm $20 million and the next day you can lose $30 million and what that does to your psyche and the emotional highs and lows, I think is something that I felt like I could personally tap into and understand. I think that those high highs, going from high highs and going from low lows, how toxic that can be and how the toxicity, I would say, of a work environment feeds into the toxicity of an already toxic relationship. And it becomes this vicious cycle that you can't really escape. So I would say that was really the main intention and choice for setting it in the finance world. It just felt like I could understand, even though I knew nothing about finance going into this, I felt like I could relate to what it is to be in that kind of work environment with those kinds of pressures and those kinds of stakes.
You're a director, or you were a director on Billions?
Yeah.
And Billions is so, it's so glamorous. It makes the whole world, that right. Whole world is just so fancy and so glamorous. And, you know, it's that whole, like, I want to live in their world kind of a thing when you watch it. But the way you make the hedge fund world look in Fair Play, it's much more, it just feels grimier and dirtier. And they're often like, they leave their apartment when it's dark out. They come back to their apartment when it's dark out. They live in kind of like a crappy neighborhood. She wears these clothes that are like, they have Ann Taylor vibes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Is that something you thought about too? Like not glamorizing finance, making it more gritty?
I think grounding it a little bit more, I would say, in reality, you know, and also these are, I think, you know, my choice was I was centering the story around two analysts who were just, you know, they were kind of at the lowest level of that.
Yeah, just starting out.
Yeah, just starting out in that, you know, in that world. They're not throwing around their money in these ridiculous kind of flashy ways because they don't have that amount of money yet. They're, you know, two steps below, you know, getting to that place. I also just thought that, you know, they're also in their 20s. They're younger adults who would want to be, I would say, first of all, because their relationship is a secret, they would want to be as far away from their work as possible as to not to run into people. And I also think given the fact that they're in their 20s, it just setting them, you know, in Chinatown, Lower East Side, just felt right. And it also, what excited me about it is that it was a different texture to the all glass, you know, midtown finance environment. And then, yeah, as you pointed out, they're like vampires, you know, they're vampires and they're workaholics. They work all day. They kind of work all night. Or sometimes they work all day, they drink all night. And then they wake up and they do it all again the next day. But yeah, they have to be up at 4 a.m. to check in on the British, you know, the London Stock Exchange and all the international stock exchanges. Is it because that's going to form like their bets for that day? So because they're so consumed by their work almost 24 hours a day, that's part of why they are not equipped to take a step back or to take a breath and to kind of evaluate the situation. They're just in this go, 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 go mentality, which is part of what leads to such a, you know, explosive act.
Yeah, it's crazy making to live that way. It's almost like it's like being in the casino, you know, never can go outside.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next. And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
I wanted to kind of zoom out a little bit and ask you, like, the businessy stuff, I guess. Like, how did you get this movie made? We were describing it, or I described it as an erotic thriller earlier. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not like your typical erotic thriller where, like, the woman goes crazy in some way or poses a real danger to the man, like I'm thinking like Fatal Attraction or something. In this one, it's the man really goes crazy. So, I mean, how did you get it made? Was there resistance to that kind of reversal?
You know, I was really lucky that I met my agent, sent the script to just people she thought would get the movie. And I was really fortunate that she sent it to MRC and T Street. They were the financing studio and the production company. And they read it pretty quickly, and they just, and then we spoke, and I pitched my vision for the film, and they were basically looking for films like this, for first-time filmmakers with like a kind of strong, bold, and in many ways risky vision, you know, for something, because they were starting their emerging filmmaker program. So they were looking to finance, you know, first-time feature films that were $5 million and under. And they really loved the script, and they really understood it. I would say, you know, in terms of the genre, I've never coined the film an erotic thriller for me. But, you know, there are definitely some influences that I've had. Like one of my favorite movies is Eyes Wide Shut. And there's a lot of crossovers to the erotic thriller, I think, with this film. But I think, you know, for me, my intention was always to make a thriller about power dynamics within a relationship. Right. Mm-hmm. And a thriller that explores male and female dynamics. You know, some of the crossovers, it happens to be highly sexual, because I do think, you know, when you're talking about power dynamics between men and women, you can't take the sex out of that. You know, when you read the script, it would say on paper, the sound of the script is not like the most commercial, you know, viable script when the, you know, film starts with a bloody oral sex scene and escalates to sexual assault. I was expecting a little bit more pushback on that, or, you know, people voicing their concerns about, you know, commercial viability because this, you know, includes a sexual assault scene. But, you know, I think that for me, it's like, it's all about execution. And when I pitched them my vision for it, and this is something that I believe for most of the films that I want to make, I believe like the tougher the subject matter, the more entertaining a film needs to be. And I think that there's a big divide in Hollywood, because you have these kind of, you know, bigger films that are only concerned with entertainment, and they have no substance and meaning, and they have nothing mm-hmm. new to say. And then you have smaller films that are exploring really tough subject matters, but they tend to be a really tough watch. And for me, I always said I wanted to take audiences on a ride, and I wanted to keep them on the edge of their seat. And I feel like if you can, that's the way to pull in a larger audience is by using the tools of entertainment, right, to get people or to get a larger audience to lean into something that they would normally be too scared to touch. So that's what I wanted to do with this film, because I thought, okay, there's a version where you could make this story pretty bleak. It could be a tough watch. It could be an uncomfortable watch. You know what I mean? And I wanted as many people to see this film as possible, because I think this is something that is incredibly important that we have to start talking about. And I made this film to start conversation and debate on these gender dynamics and these power dynamics. So for me, it's exciting to figure out how can I use the tools of entertainment in an exciting and nuanced and compelling way to get a large audience to lean into something that they would normally be turned off, you know, by.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the bloody oral sex scene. I've been trying to like kind of think about what purpose the scene serves. So basically, Luke and Emily have sex in a bathroom, and he goes down on her, and she's on her period, and there's blood everywhere. And it's like, it's kind of a fun, joyful scene. I don't think I've ever seen a scene like that in a movie before. And it was like kind of delightful to see. And I thought one reason to do a scene like that is to show that Luke character is like a progressive kind of guy, because he's not grossed out. He's, you know, he's just like, they're just happy together. And then Yeah. And then to have the contrast at the end, there's another bloody scene, but it's not a happy scene. Yeah. So it sounds like there was no pushback on showing that. That's surprising.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because also all the producers on this, my film, were men. The financing studio were all men. but they found it fun and charming, and they felt like that's the way that you will fall in love with these characters, because it's charming, because it's messy, because it's human. You know, I didn't get any pushback on that. And I will say, really, yeah, my intention for that scene was to show, you know, as you mentioned, and talking about how progressive he is, but I really wanted to set up that on the one hand, you know, this is a character who is not threatened by women. You know, I mean, how could he be threatened by her if he has her blood on his face? And I think that was really important, because I also, again, didn't want to show a stereotypical villain, and that, you know, it's not one or the other. It's not like, okay, he's someone who is just threatened by all women and that's it. No. I mean, this is a guy who fell in love with her, you know, for the very same things that he ends up later on being threatened by. That was something that was interesting for me to explore, to show that it's not black and white, you know, that these things are messy and confusing and sometimes in opposition to each other. But I will say, you know, the other things that opening scene was doing was foreshadowing, you know, some of the violence to come, you know, at the end of the movie. But I would say that the main purpose was just getting you to fall in love with these characters. You have to fall in love with them in the first 5 minutes of the movie, because I would say, you know, after that, she gets the promotion pretty quickly, and then their relationship gets flipped quite quickly after
that. It's a great way to fall in love with characters that I don't think anyone's really thought of before. Do you think this movie could you have made this movie before Me Too? I think of it kind of and I heard someone else say this, it's not my brilliant idea, but like as a post-Me Too movie, this would kind of fit the bill.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's a great question. I don't know. I mean, I think that it's something that again, like this is something that I've been experiencing and feeling for the last, I don't know, 12 years, you know, again, in different shades of it, different, you know, different circumstances. But these are tensions that I've felt since, you know, my early 20s. And then women that are much, you know, older than me, like this was their whole life. So it's like, in a way, it's a film that I think could have been made at any time. Would it have the impact that it, you know, or would people, you know, would it have felt too soon? Totally possible. You know, I do think for the reason why I wanted to set this in a post Me Too world was to show that, okay, we've progressed this far, but now what? You know, there are still these tensions that we experience in our relationships and in the workplaces that again, we, you know, for me, we normalize. And it's part of normalizing this behavior that makes it so problematic.
Have you figured it out, Chloe? You made this movie. you're like cognizant of this dynamic now. Like, how do you deal with it? Now you're more successful than ever, I imagine.
You know, it's so funny. So I did meet someone about 6 months ago, and it has totally broken the mold. And it has totally, broken the cycle. He's not American. He's from Italy. And I think that this is actually what's kind of interesting. There are two things here that I've been thinking about. First of all, this is a man who was raised by a woman who was the breadwinner of the family. So that's the house that he grew up under. And so I think that definitely factors into things that that make it more healthy and more acceptable. And the other thing is, like, you know, there's this thing where I just feel like it's very American that our whole self-worth is based on achieving, right? And I do think that is a very American thing. And there's something about Europeans and especially Italians where their self-worth is not about achieving. It's about lots of other things. Like, it's about cooking and how well can you cook, you know, this ragu, and how well can you cook a carbonara? And like, you know, that's how he almost values his self-worth. And it's, you know, he doesn't see my success as a poor reflection of himself in any way. That's what I've been reflecting on and thinking and feel like that's added to an actually healthy finally a healthy dynamic in my personal life. So I do have hope. I mean, look, for many years when I was experiencing this, I was undermining myself and I was undermining my success, you know, but this was, you know, at the time it was all subconscious. And again, it all just felt like a normalized, you know, thing to do. And after making this movie and, you know, after having all the experiences, you know, had I not met him and if I were going out in the dating scene, I were to, you know, feel those kinds of tensions again, there's no way that I would ever undermine myself. There's no way I would ever undermine my success. I would never, you know, if someone can't deal with it, then I'm out, you know, and that's the bottom line.
That's great. Well, congratulations on your success. I can't wait to see what you have coming next. And Chloe, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh yeah. Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Chloe DeMont is the writer and director of Fair Play, available on Netflix right now, so go watch that if you haven't already. And this episode was produced by Jared Downing and Shayna Roth, and we'll be back on Saturday for a regular Slate Money.